NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
The Flight Safety Detectives is bringing on a new sponsor, Piston Powered, a power-by-the-hour program for owners of piston-powered aircraft that can stabilize the long-term cost of owning your airplane.
Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
It's just you and me today. Greg is on an airplane right now, as usual, and I'm getting ready to get on one myself.
I'm the only one not flying this week.
Yeah, it's been a busy time for both Greg and I. I'm actually heading home tomorrow, first time in a while.
Oh, good.
So we've had some inquiries from some of our viewers about some recent events involving Qantas Airlines. And Qantas has a very, very good safety record. They've never lost the hull loss of an airplane, but that's a little bit of a misnomer because they have had at least one airplane damaged that it should have been a hull loss, but it was repaired instead. But in any event, it's a record that's nobody else can equal. So it's quite a feat on their part. All right, but we've had a couple of engine problems with them recently that have made the news and made some of our listeners concerned. So I believe you have the event.
Yes, indeed. The first event involved an A380, which isn't used by any U.S. operator, but several overseas operators, including Qantas, operate quite a few. This was one that was flown into Los Angeles, and they took the opportunity to do some maintenance on it in early December of 2023. During that maintenance operation, there was a borescope inspection of the engines, and there is a tool that they use for moving the fan blades, a nylon tool of some kind, that was left inside the engine. Now, here's where things get a little tricky. They actually realized that they couldn't find the tool during the maintenance operation. However, at the time this happened, they did not follow the typical lost tool process for trying to track down where the tool was. They released the airplane, and roughly 3 weeks, almost a month later, on January 1st of 2024, it returned to Los Angeles for another set of maintenance. That's when they found the tool. And for those of you who are looking at the video version of this, we're flashing a picture of the nylon tool, which is toward the bottom of the engine fan area there. It's kind of wavy and bent. That was damage that happened apparently during its exposure during nearly a month of flying. And there was a fairly detailed investigation by the ATSB of Australia where they cited the lack of following procedure as the issue there. Now, the ATSB report aside, this is not something that is completely unknown. There have been tools left inside of aircraft after maintenance operations. During my time at Boeing, I heard of many instances where there were tools left in during the manufacturing process. Sometimes they were discovered before they got sold to the customer. Sometimes they weren't. So in general, John, how does this sort of thing happen? Because we have maintenance technicians, very well trained, very regulated world that they're in. You have to sign out anytime you have a tool. You have to sign the tool back in. How can they mess this up?
Well, they do mess it up occasionally. Usually it's because of pressure, time pressure. Get the airplane out is the number one reason. Occasionally, although I've never seen it, I imagine people may forget some tools, especially their own personal tools, not the ones that they check out of the tool room. But it does happen. And most of the time it's left inside the cowling, not inside the engine. And the newspaper reports never get that right. Because if you left the tool anywhere in the gas path, that means from the front of the engine to the back of the engine, inside the engine, that engine would self-destruct. You would destroy the engine. But it's along the sides, both the sides and the bottom and the top, actually, all around the engine, where maintenance is performed, because that's where all the bits and pieces are. If you leave it in there, most of the time, it doesn't cause any damage at all. In this case, it looks like it did beat itself to death, and that's because it was connected. Now, the reason why that tool was there is they were doing an inspection on the inside of the engine. So you got this great big engine that needs to be rotated, and most people don't realize, but the fan in the front that they see, you can spin that all day long. The engine's not spinning. All right, so it's just spinning the turbine wheel, but the engine itself is not turning. And you want to get to the hot section of the airplane. So the front of the engine is considered the cold section, and the rear of the engine is considered the hot section. So yet we have on the engine itself, there's ports, which are nothing but a hole that has a bolt in it. And you take the bolt out, and now you can look inside. And usually we have a borescope type device, which is a camera on the end of a probe, and we can stick it inside the engine and we can look in the hot section and look for damage. But you can't go all the way around the engine. So what you have to do is get your camera essentially in position and then rotate the engine. Well, since you can't rotate it from the front, how are you going to get it to turn? Well, there's a device that you go to the gearbox of the engine. The gearbox drives the generator and the hydraulic pump, all the accessories. And you put this tool on. Again, you unbolt the cover, put it in, and it's nylon. And you can rotate the engine around slowly while someone else is looking at the camera and looking for problems, making sure the engine hasn't started to develop any overtemp problems or any other kinds of problems. So after you get the engine rotated around and you do that, you might be doing more, do it more than once. All right, when you finish, the procedure is you take out your borescope and you put the bolt back in the hole, and then you disconnect this ratchet type device that's on the gearbox and put the cover on it. It typically doesn't leak oil from those access plates. The one that you put the camera in, if you forget it, it burns the hole right in the cowling. So the next flight, there's a nice big hole, bullseye type hole in the cowling because of the hot gas that's coming up. So that only goes one flight before you know about it. You know, in this case, it went a lot more than one flight.
Looking at the photos from the report, it didn't sound like there was any serious damage to the engine. Obviously, the tool was a little bent. And because there was no serious damage, no serious injuries, no substantial damage to the aircraft, and this did happen in the United States, it's not reportable to the NTSB because they have very specific criteria for reporting incidents and accidents. This is neither. And to the best of my knowledge, it's not even reportable as an incident to the FAA. So if this were a U.S. operator and this happened, what's the likelihood that this would have been known outside of the maintenance shop?
Well, you would have filled out a report, all right, service difficulty report or mechanical interruption report, depending on the events, on how it was discovered and did it cause a delay or whatever. So there are forms that you would fill out, and the FAA would have access to those. They don't necessarily go to the FAA, but they would have access to them since it was a U.S. facility. Although, if the airplane's not registered in the U.S., The FAA has got a very little to do with it. So it depends on whose mechanics they were using in this case. I think the mechanics that Qantas uses in this event occurred in Los Angeles are employees of Qantas. So that would be reported to the CASA, the Australian equivalent of the FAA. And they did do an investigation, which, and you're right, we would not have done an investigation. They did a full-blown investigation into it, and basically because of their SMS program. All right, so under SMS, that would be a very big requirement to be met, because the Australians are really ahead of everybody with their SMS programs. So they're into it with both feet, so to speak. So they would have reported it. Their equivalent of the FAA would have been involved, and they were involved, and so we got the report out. They most likely would have chastised the airline as well as some individuals, at the very least, maybe more. But there would have been some sort of action taken.
Now, I think this is a positive in that, as you said before, this happened not to a U.S. Operator. And because it happened to be Australia, which is very good at doing reports on less than major events, this is a learning opportunity for the rest of the industry and for the public at large. It's not a question of, ooh, Qantas, they're a bad airline, they've dropped the ball on this. I mean, frankly, I think this is something that happens regularly at major airlines around the world. And almost never do you see this ending up in any sort of media coverage. And in Australia, this had fairly significant media coverage. And because of that, we found out about it. And again, that report, which is going to be connected to the page that is supporting this episode, that's available for you to download and learn from yourself.
Yeah, it's sometimes unfortunate. I mean, mistakes are made. People leave tools behind often, and they have no problems, so to speak. You know, they're just in there. In fact, I probably have a wrench or two that I found, you know, during the course of maintenance that somebody had left behind. Tool control is a big issue with the airlines. With the aviation industry as a whole, tool control is a big deal. So, you know, many of us, if you looked at my toolbox when I was working, you would have seen that I had a spot for every wrench, a spot for every ratchet, every socket, every screwdriver, not quite shadow boarded on the toolbox I carried around, but everything was fixed in place. So if there was something missing, it would come up. You'd see it immediately. On my rollaway, my big toolbox, it's like a big tool cabinet. Many of the tools in there were in shadow boards. So in an instant view, you could tell if you were missing something. And I did it because I was cheap and I didn't want to lose some of those tools. And the procedures. You know, you're signing your name to certain things. And that's one of, in this case, in that report, they talk about somebody signing their name to it as removing it. It wasn't removed. So they don't go into detail on that particular piece of it, but somebody would be in trouble for that.
Now, as an aside, as a GA pilot who's not a mechanic of any kind, my level of diligence when it comes to making sure there's nothing loose around the airplane is if I see something that's out of place or not tied down, if I do my pre-flight inspection, obviously that's a signal for me to ask the question, what's going on here? Does this have to be fixed before I leave? But what I usually control is what's inside the cockpit. I do an inspection with a flashlight under the seats whenever I start to fly my Cessna. Somebody even leaves a pen or a gum wrapper or whatever. I'm going to stash that, zip it up somewhere so it's not going to be floating around the cabin, because I don't know what problem a small something can have that gets stuck in the wrong place. I don't want to find out when I'm flying. So I very carefully take care of business and clean the place out before I fly. I do the same after I finish the flight, before I lock up the aircraft.
Hey, I remember years ago at Oshkosh that they, I think it was a P-51. But anyway, a high-performance airplane flew upside down, and when he righted his back up, something in the cabin got jammed in his pedals, and he ended up crashing because of it. Jammed his flight controls. He didn't know what it was, had no control over it. If he'd known, maybe he would have been able to correct it. But in any event, it was a disaster. You know, you don't want any debris running around the cabin, no matter how simple it is.
So another thing about the Qantas event is the report was released, I believe, the 14th of November of this year. About 6 to 8 days after it was released, there was an event with the Qantas 737 at Sydney's main airport, where it had an engine failure during takeoff. Some hot pieces came out the back of the engine. There was a fire on the grass near the runway, and it got a whole lot of media coverage. And there was a lot of conflation between this event that got reported on that happened back in late 2023 and the event that just happened last month. We're recording this, by the way, on December 2nd. This happened less than a month ago that you had this event at the Kingsford Smith Airport. And the average person might look at this media report and say, oh, Qantas had these two problems. Is there a relationship? In my opinion, there was no relationship. Two completely different kinds of problems. The second one, the engine fire and the engine failure, that's under investigation. There's no indication that it was in maintenance involvement or anything like that. It is under investigation. But it just goes to show you that when it comes to events happening, if you have more than a couple of events happening with an airline, especially if the first event gets a whole lot of attention, any subsequent event will get way more attention than it would have otherwise.
Yes. And in the case of the engine problems, you know, I don't know that many people realize that how hot a turbine engine runs today. They're actually running temperatures in the gas flow that are higher than what's required to melt the bits and pieces inside the engine. And the only reason why they don't melt is because of airflow. Right, so they're controlling it with air. And it's an interesting process sometimes, where you have engine air that's in a cone of a certain diameter, and it's surrounded by air from the front of the engine that's cooler. So it's like ducting the hot air through the turbine and out the tailpipe. So it's using air as an insulator. So it's a very interesting process called gas flow. But in any event, anything that disrupts that flow of air inside an engine has a high likelihood of melting some of those turbine wheels. And that's going to end up with an airplane coming back, especially right after the takeoff. And that's when the engines are at their highest operating temperature, is on takeoff. So, and that's what it sounded like here with the 737 that returned. But interestingly, the comments that came in were not so much about the engine and the fact that it came apart and they returned to the gate, returned to sender, we call them. Mm. All right, so they had a return. The question involved around the fuel dumping. All right, so apparently there was another news story about an airplane that came back, and they had to circle around for a couple of hours to burn off fuel before they landed. And that gets to a problem with the big airplanes and the little airplanes. Right? So an airplane can take off with X amount of weight, but it has to take a lesser amount to land. That's because of the structure of the airplane. How much can it take on landing? Because we all know the landing sometimes can come down pretty stiff. So there's a whole formula that the engineers use when they're designing the landing gear. How much abuse can it take? And so on. So in the very big airplanes, they carry over 30,000 gallons of fuel. You know, some of them are 50,000 gallons of fuel. But in any event, they carry a lot of fuel. Well, if you have a problem immediately after takeoff, the airplane's too heavy to land. So you have a choice to fly around and make circles in the sky until you burn off the fuel down to a certain level, or they have a system on the airplane that allows you to dump the fuel off. and you have to have a minimum altitude, because when you're dumping this kerosene at altitude, it will evaporate before it hits the ground. But you have to have a minimum altitude. And my memory says it's like 3,000 feet, but I don't saw it hold me to that. It's whatever it is. It's a minimum altitude. But that's on wide-body airplanes. 757s, I don't know about the A350, the A330, some of the smaller airplanes, all the A320 series, 737s, DC-9 series, they do not have a fuel dump. And the main reason why that is that their takeoff weight and their landing weight is close together. So if you take off and you fly for 30 minutes, you're probably below the maximum landing weight. And even if you're not below it, the airplane has enough structure and you follow a different landing procedure that you can land it safely. And it's considered an overweight landing. You do an inspection to make sure you haven't broken anything and you're good to go. All right, so that's the reason why, or answers the question that we've received from one of our listeners about dumping fuel, who dumps fuel. So the answer to who dumps fuel, it's big airplanes, wide-bodied airplanes, twin-aisle airplanes, because they carry so much fuel. Basically, the single-aisle airplanes, 757, 737, A320, they don't have a fuel dump system because typically their landing weight and takeoff weight are so close together that they don't need the dump system.
And fuel dumping is a fairly rare event. In fact, there was a report by the FAA that looked at the period from 2015 to 2020, and there were, on average, 15 reported fuel dumpings over that time, each year on average. Now, and most of the time that happens, it's not going to be overpopulated areas. And I believe that report was written in part as a fallout from what happened in early 2020. There was, I believe, a Delta 767 flying over Los Angeles, which for whatever reason had to dump fuel. And it dumped fuel that hit the ground in and around one or more schools in the Los Angeles school district, which caused a whole lot of media reports about that and reported sickness that happened because of it. And a whole lot of heat was put on the airline industry and Delta in particular. One of the things that came out was this report. And what struck me is that it's so very rare. Now, they said that there are probably some unreported non-emergency dumpings that happen, but given the 25 or however many millions of flights were happening in the United States, it only happened 15 times per year. And although it didn't state specifically where it happened, I suspect most of the time it is not a dire emergency. The airline crew has a chance to go out over the ocean or go out over a relatively unpopulated area and definitely stay at a high enough altitude where it's not going to cause a problem on the ground.
Yes, I remember that incident. I actually had people with wet skin, young people with wet skin, which is an irritant that's not going to kill them, but you know, it definitely needed to be looked at. So I think we answered the inquiries from the couple of people that were interested in that. We're getting into holiday season. We're looking to change up our program for the next year, the new year. So we're working on some improvements based upon, a lot of them based upon what we've heard from you, our listeners. So we might have some exciting things to announce here in the next few weeks.
And as many of you who follow our show, you very likely follow other shows in the same general area, that is talking about aviation incidents, either civil or military. And we appreciate the audience that we have. And if you like what we do, tell other people to come. If you don't like what we do, tell us about it. We might make some improvements.
And we've actually made some changes from the comments that people have put in. One of them is shorter shows. You know, so we have shortened up our shows, but it's sometimes very tough to shorten the show up when you have a lot of information to give up. You know, a lot of people go once over lightly. I listen to the other shows too. and they go once over lightly, and we tend to dig in and try to explain more. You know, we have a couple goals here. We want to help educate pilots to what's going on, and that's where we get into the last word about pre-flights and pre-planning and all that. So that's aimed at trying to remind pilots what they need to be doing, because we all need to be reminded sometimes. And also a lot of the general public that has an interest in aviation, we try to explain it, you know, not down into the nitty-gritty technical stuff, but enough so that anybody that has a more than a passing interest in it can get some understanding of what goes on in the business, right? And it's not all magic in the background. It's a lot of common sense procedures.
And you don't have to be a pilot or an engineer or a mechanic to understand common sense. And we try to break it down in ways that we can tell our own colleagues, because again, as an engineer, I know very little about the details of other aspects of aviation, but almost any kind of technical endeavor you can think of is involved in some aspect of aviation. So we try to communicate not just with the general public, but within the aviation community, which is a very diverse culturally and technically and education-wise.
Well, okay, Todd. I think we've covered that subject enough to satisfy our viewers. So I'll leave you the second last word.
Well, the second to last word this time is easy, because as I pointed out before, sometimes things come to light, not because they're immediately dangerous, but because they're potentially dangerous, and they happen to hit the perfect set of circumstances where it had wide public view. This event in Australia with a Qantas airliner was one of those. It typically doesn't have this kind of exposure. We're glad this one did, because it gave us an opportunity to explain something in detail and to give you some supporting material so you can look into it yourself and come to your own conclusions.
Yes. And again, I'll just sound like the broken record. You know, if you're going to go flying, all our pilots out there, if you're going to go flying, please do a good job of pre-planning. You know, do it from home. Do it again at the airport. If they don't agree, redo it again. See if you miss something. Make sure you do the weather here, there, and everywhere in between. Right, that's the NTSB is out with a report just within the last few days about general aviation accidents. And there's a lot of things that they have in that report that we've been talking about. And the pre-flight on the airplane, I've been pushing on it pretty hard for years. AOPA has started to pick up on that as well. If you look at the accidents, and many of the accidents that we look at, there's, you know, accidents are a chain. They're not one event. They're two, three, four, five different things that have gone wrong that if they didn't, the accident wouldn't have happened. And many of them have their origins on a pre-flight that wasn't done properly, isn't thorough. And I preach to my mechanics whenever I can about help the pilots out. If you did the annual, walk around with them, do a pre-flight, make sure they know what they're looking at. Because many of them do a pre-flight and they don't even know what they're looking at, because it's, you know, buried, and you get a small view of the flight controls, the linkage. So what am I looking at when I look at the ailerons? Well, you better be looking to see that all the hardware is there. It appears to be tight and it has a cotter pin in it, a locking device. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do. And I worked the crash myself after leaving the NTSB, where the flight controls were disconnected and the linkage was fully exposed. Fully exposed. I can't believe that the pilot didn't see it. And it didn't come up, it came apart slowly. And, you know, so I just shake my head sometimes with all this. So please, please do a good pre-flight. When you get into the air, put your head on a swivel. We still have a lot of airplanes flying with a lot of new people in them. So pay attention to your surroundings and please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.